The theme at the summer camps this year for the teen camps was leadership. And each of the days of the summer camp was a focus on a different quality of leadership. So I had an opportunity to go to a teen camp this year as well as a preteen camp. And one of the themes or sub-themes under the idea of leadership, as they were looking at leaders, people of character, well, what were some of the qualities of these leaders? And so I had the opportunity to observe that at the teen camp and then lead it at a preteen camp. And I asked, what makes a good leader? And it's interesting, when you ask that question, different people will have different ideas as to what makes a good leader. And I had one little fellow ask or say, to be a good leader, you have to be the boss. It's later talking to the camp nurse. And she said, I was wondering how you were going to handle that one. And my response was, sometimes people think that being a leader means being a boss. And it reminds me of the cartoon, and some of you may have seen it, where there is a picture of a group of people, and behind them is a man on a high place with a whip, and his label on him was boss. And then there's another picture of the same group of people all pulling on a rope, and then there's one person out in front pulling with them, and the cartoon pointed to that one, said that one's the leader. So the description I thought was apt when you have a picture of a boss who's got the one who's got the whip, and the leader was out front showing the way. And in that sense, as I explained to the young man, or the youngster at the time, the preteen, that leadership is something that we can all do. You don't have to be the boss to be the leader, because we can all do the right thing, go the right way, regardless of whether other people follow. That is a characteristic of leadership, is those who serve and lead by example. So leaders are servants. And this, of course, approach takes character, which can then be defined as knowing right from wrong. And of course, right from wrong can mean spiritually, can mean morally, right from wrong. And then once you know the difference between right and wrong, then you do the right thing. You've probably heard the definition of character, that doing what is right even when no one is looking. So the character of a person is his or her inner makeup. It's who they are, and God is then the ultimate source of godly character. Well, at the United Youth Camps, that's where we have an opportunity to practice character, learning how to serve, how to lead. And it doesn't matter whether it's in the dorm or on the field, if it's with a team, how to set a good example. Because that opportunity in summer camp affords the chance for campers and the staffers, to each of them, to be able to opportunities to learn what's the right thing to do and then do the thing that is right. So everyone has an opportunity to participate in leadership. Well, the characteristic of the leader that I chose for a presentation I want to go over today is the characteristic of determination. And there's a biblical character that exemplifies the concept of determination. And of course, determination is someone who has the purpose to accomplish the right goals regardless of the obstacles or opposition. So determination means then stick-to-itiveness, just sticking to it no matter what. My youngest brother was age 26, started college 8 times in 8 years. But he had too much fun going to college. He was in plays and musicals and having a great time and never spent a lot of time in his studies. So at that time, it was the limit for getting into the military was age 26. So right under the limit at 26, he joined the Marines. And he had an opportunity to come and visit me after that. And I said, well, perhaps you could tell me, why did you join the Marines? And he said, well, there were two things. One, I wanted to learn how to get up in the morning. And number two, I wanted to learn how to finish what I start. Now, those are admirable goals for somebody who wants to make their way in life. You got to learn to get up in the morning to make the day worthwhile instead of getting up at noon or one in the afternoon. The other one was finish what you start. Would that we all had that written really down. I know that that's. And so I said, well, how did it go on learning those two things? He says, oh, the Marines taught those two things in the first week. He said the next 4 years was redundant. So the Marines obviously had a level of determination that he was going to be a good Marine. And he accomplished his goals, regardless of the obstacles or opposition. He accomplished his goals, of those two goals, although he accomplished them much quicker than he thought that perhaps he would. So to have determination, you accomplish the right goals regardless of your obstacles. Now, this concept or this characteristic of determination often separates the dreamers from the doers. I have lots of dreams. I have a lot of things I want to do. And they're exciting things. And I can write them down, and they're just fun to think about. I can lay in bed and ponder them. I think about them while I'm driving. I think about them everywhere, about all the neat things I want to do. And it was many years ago, I was reading a book written by Robert Ringer. I think that one was Looking Out for Number One. And he defined people who are realistic this simply this way. He said, if you're realistic, you are accomplishing your objectives. Ooh, that one kind of hurt because I had all these objectives and yet they weren't all being accomplished. In other words, I wasn't being realistic. And so how much determination did I really have? Maybe I wasn't as realistic as I should have been. I wasn't realistic about me, or I wasn't realistic about the obstacles. I wasn't realistic about the opposition that I would encounter. And so this whole idea of determination then being a character issue is I had to question myself. Did I have the level of determination it took to take a dream and then take that dream and do something, make it into reality? Was I being realistic about all the things that surrounded that dream? And I guess we all have dreams, hopes, wants, wishes, or desires. It's what are we doing to turn that into reality? Well, there's a biblical leader that we talk about when we talk about determination. You may, of course, find your own examples, but this particular leader has a fellow by the name of Nehemiah. And, of course, you know that he's the second shortest person in the Bible, right? Nehemiah, you know the shorter one is Bildad the shoe height. So we have those. The character of Nehemiah is what we're going to examine. And Nehemiah, so we can turn to Nehemiah. We'll start in Nehemiah 1:1. We're going to go through a quick look at Nehemiah. Well, maybe not a quick look, but we're going to have plenty of time for lunch today. And the book begins in the winter time, about the year 445 B.C., while Nehemiah was at the winter home of the king of Persia. Now, this time period is when the Jews had been taken captive, and they had been hauled away from what was the land of Judah, which we now call Israel, and they had been hauled away to Persia as captives, as people. And that occurred some, 90 years earlier. And they were hauled away as slaves. They were servants in a strange land. Today we call Persia Iran, but it had different borders than what it does now. And so about 54,000 Jews had been allowed to return to Judah. And so they were living back in their homeland. And they had rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. And we read about this in the book of Ezra. In fact, the book of Ezra and Nehemiah used to be called Ezra 1 and Ezra 2, as it was originally titled. Today we title them Ezra and then Nehemiah. Well, about 12 years before Nehemiah went back, Ezra left and took another 1,750 people. with him to focus on rebuilding the temple. And if we go then to verse 11 in chapter 1, we see that Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king. Now, the cupbearer is a very important position because the king, being king, is a tough job. It's also the one with the most power of a king among all of these different provinces, and he has the power of life and death over everyone else, which means that everyone either wants to curry favor with the king, or they want to kill him and take his job, because they want to have the power of life and death over everyone else. And so every sip that the king took, every bite of food that he took, he was subject to being poisoned. So he had a food taster or a cupbearer to sample everything in front of him. And only if that person survived would then the king take his portion of the food. So Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king. And what a better kind of person to do than to put one of the slave people as one of the cupbearers, because those are the people most likely to revolt and rebel. They would have to kill their own people in order to kill the king, and they were less likely to do so. And after all, if one of them died, well, they just replaced that one with another person, a slave person. And so being a cupbearer was a very important position. So if we read then, we go back to Nehemiah in verse 2, Nehemiah got some news. And let me get to my spot here. But, and Nehemiah received news that he was very saddened about. And the news, of course, was that the walls of Jerusalem were not rebuilt. They were still broken down. And now Nehemiah was normally a happy person. And we all know it's a lot more fun being happy than being sad. So when we get news that's uncomfortable, that's sad, that may depress us, of course, then and King James uses the word countenance. And the words were that, you know, his countenance had fallen, because in verse 4, when Nehemiah heard the words, "I sat down and wept and mourned for days and fasted and prayed." Well, what did he fast and pray about? Was that there was great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and the gates are burned with fire. So people were trying to make sure that Jerusalem could never again be a safe and a great city. There were enemy peoples around, and those people had surrounded them. And so one way to make sure that a city was vulnerable was to keep the walls broken and the gates burned. And to build the city gates is no small thing. Heavy timbers were taken. If you recall the story of Samson, uprooted one of the gates and hauled him off to a hill. So to keep the city, and of course, when you have the walls around a city, in fact, if you take a look on driving here today, as we did coming from the freeway, you'll notice these big walls along the highway for these housing developments. And those big fences or walls keep out what? Well, they'll keep out dogs, they'll keep out coyotes, and keep out anything that would come in and risk and be a hazard to those, to the people living there. Well, in those days, the hazards were bigger. Wolves, big cats, bears, lions, and enemy people, you know, who would come and prey upon them. And so the walls were broken down, and of course this meant the people were vulnerable to being attacked and crimes committed upon them. And so naturally then Nehemiah, who was not born there but his ancestors were, was very upset, you know, that all of the people that lived there and now were repopulating the area were basically unsafe. And so if we take a look here, and we keep reading on, that if in verse 5, what did Nehemiah do? And we read in verse 5, the first thing he did was he prayed. And he prayed because he had a vision in his mind. And he asked God to give him favor in sight of the king. So if you take a look in verse 5. And I beseech you, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and terrible God, that keeps covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you, both I and my father's house have sinned. So he's acknowledging the truth, that they didn't do all of the things that they should have done. And that's really the heart of repentance, is being able to turn, acknowledging the past, what we've done wrong, and then asking God's forgiveness so we can do what was right. But Nehemiah continues on. We've dealt very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which you have commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I beseech you, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if you turn to me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost parts of heaven, yet I will gather them from thence, and I will bring them to the place that I have chosen to set my name there. Now these are the servants of your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by thy strong hand. And so finally, in verse 11, he says, I beseech you, O Lord, now let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name and prosper. I pray you, your servant, this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And then we read, he says, for I was the king's cupbearer. In other words, the mercy in front of the king. So he's praying to God and acknowledging that they didn't do what they should have, the people didn't. And now they're turning to, and with that acknowledgement, he said, I know we've done wrong and we need to do right. And so in order for this problem to be fixed, for the people to return and the vision of the walls to be rebuilt, I'm asking for favor in the sight of the king. Now, very few people will ever see the king. Just imagine when you have thousands or millions of subjects, how many people ever see the king? Just not very many. And yet here was a person whom God was calling, who was right there every meal, every day. That's a pretty close relationship to the king. And so he was asking God now, please overlook our transgressions. Isn't that what we do? Every Passover, we ask God to overlook our transgressions, to put them away, and give us a new life. And this is what Nehemiah was doing here, was saying, put away those transgressions. We've done wrong, and you did just exactly as you said would happen. We'd be scattered to the parts of the wind, and now let's gather back together, and I need your help to do that. And so we'll take a look at how God answered then that prayer. In Nehemiah 2, if we take a look then, in verse 2, it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid, and I said to the king, May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Now, we all like to be around happy people, don't you? Don't you? Some people, you just come into the room and they're just bubbling and it's pretty exciting to be there. And wow, they're the life of the party. I mean, it's kind of, they're fun people to be around. And apparently the king thought that of Nehemiah. He was always a happy person, just noticeably that he was always on the upbeat side. And it would be kind of fun to be one of those people. I don't know that my wife would say I'm always that way. And don't answer that. But the king noticed the difference in Nehemiah, that says, whoa, there's something different here. And the king, I presume, was observant of that because, after all, if Nehemiah was taking the poison voluntarily, he would probably be a little sad. So the king is probably watchful and wants some. And it's good to have happy people around anyway. So what did Nehemiah then say? What did the king say after Nehemiah asked? And the king said to me, "What is it you want?" Okay. I have an uncle who has a number of children, and he's seems to be rather abrupt from time to time. So when he gets a call from one of them, he doesn't say, "What is it you want?" He says, "How much do you want?" Because he already knows what the call is going to be about. And I don't think we have to describe too much about the much part. How much what? But there's always a dollar sign attached to it. How much do you want this time? So sometimes they'll go on for a minute or two and describe their circumstances. So let's cut to the chase. How much do you want? Well, the king says, "What is it you want?" The king could read between the lines. Well, there's got to be a reason, okay? You know, your ancestors are buried back in Jerusalem. That's true. Even though you've never been there, Nehemiah, what is it? What do you want? Because what is the king? Why is he the king? He can make decisions. He has the capacity to make a decision, because if he was indecisive, would he still be the king? Probably not. So he made, you know, he's able to cut right to the heart of the matter. What do you want? Okay, are we able to do that? Can we cut to the heart of a matter and say, what is it? you know, what will solve this problem? Now, you'll notice that Nehemiah said that he had prayed, he recounted that he had prayed to the God of heaven. And I answered the king. Now, we read that he had prayed earlier so that he would be prepared for this opportunity, this circumstance. And so, and we read this, in fact, we read early in here, that the first thing that Nehemiah did was pray. He was beseeching God what to do. And that's one of the characteristics or qualities of a leader when we look at determination. His first thing was he prayed. He prayed for forgiveness. He was praying for direction. He asked God to look after him and to his people. He reminded God of his promises. And here it is. He's restating here in Nehemiah 2 that he had prayed before answering the king. Now, in industry, for many years, if you really screwed up something and you were called up to the boss's office, we call that doing the rug dance. You're sitting and standing in front of the boss who's behind the big desk, and you're standing there on the carpet. And then he asks the hard, hard questions. We call that the rug dance, because you're standing on there just hoping for the best that things would come out. It was many years ago, there was a young IBM executive from International Business Machines, and he had just made a $2 million mistake. Company chairman was very unhappy. Calls the young executive into his office for the rug dance. And the young man said to his boss, he said, "I suppose you'll be wanting my resignation." And the head of IBM says, no, he says, "You made the mistake. You're going to work here until you earn every bit of it back and more, and you're going to pay us back for this mistake." Now, in other words, the young executive was not going to get off the hook. He was going to have to make better decisions, learn from this, and then do better next time. So the head of the company had the confidence that the man would learn from that mistake, and he had the capacity then to fix the problem. And so the king here in Nehemiah's case asked the question, "What is it you want?" And Nehemiah goes ahead and responds and says, "I want to..." If it pleases the king, he learned to use his words very nice and diplomatically. In other words, if it's okay with you, king, and if you think well of me, if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. And of course, to rebuild a city means you rebuild the walls. And the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, How long will your journey take, and when will you get back? The king didn't say yes or no. He assumed the yes and went into the details. If anybody sold cars, you know that the car salesman always comes in and says, what color do you like? He doesn't say, do you want to buy a car? Don't buy a car. It's which one do you want, basically. It's not a yes or a no. And so this was the same thing. Well, the yes was already now presumed. And which, you know, how long is this going to take? You know, let's deal with the details. He's the problem solver. He's the king. What are we asking here? You know, is this going to take a period of time? And so it doesn't tell us the time, but he says, I set a time. Okay, in other words, there was a certain time frame that he would allow to do this, and we learn later that Nehemiah was there for 12 years. And as we read later. And also, if you take a look at this verse in verse 6, 2:6, it says, the king with the queen sitting beside him. This is unusual. This is an extraordinarily high level of trust that they had in this cupbearer, Nehemiah. So he was allowed to be in the presence of the king and the queen at the same time. So God answered the prayer when the king by the king's response, because when Nehemiah asked, you know, said a set of time, and he says, and if it please the king, oh, by the way, here's a few of the details we'll need along the way. I'll need letters to the governors of the various areas. I'll need some wood from the forest to make the gates. I'll need to have the authorization of transport through your military garrisons in this whole big area. So we'll need to have a few official letters. I, as one of a slave people, can't just go waltzing through your empire wherever I want to go. So I'll need some official letters, which means with the wax and the king's seal on it, in order to get that authorization. And in fact, the king then made him the governor of Judah. And so he got letters, the appropriate letters, and went along. Now, so he overcame this opportunity, this scary part. He set a goal. But he didn't set a goal mindlessly. He set a goal with something in mind, so that when the king asked him a question, he was prepared to answer. I'll need transport letters. I'll need letters authorizing me to cut from the king's forest so that I can make the timbers. In other words, get the supplies that I need. He was prepared. When we set a goal, are we prepared to follow through with it? Are we prepared to follow through? So it's not just an empty goal. It's not just a dream. It's something, are we prepared to be able to do what it takes to follow through on that goal? If we move along then, we read in verses 11 and 12 that Nehemiah transported, and I forgot to look on a map to see if it was 1,000 or 2,000 miles, but it was a long ways back to Jerusalem. And when he got there, we read in verses 11 and 12 that Nehemiah got there and he arrived. He says, I went to Jerusalem, and staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. So, and we read around this, and he rode basically around the city, as we read in verse 13. And he saw all the broken gates. He was examining, looking, he was watching to see how big of a job this was. Remember, he didn't grow up there. This was a huge job. And he did not want to trigger opposition by saying anything about what he was there for. Because if he would have said anything, what do you suppose the opposition would have tried right off the bat? Well, if we eliminate Nehemiah, we don't have this problem anymore. This was a very dangerous world. And so Nehemiah wisely said nothing. He took a few people with him, but he was the only one mounted on horseback or whatever he was riding. And if we go back to verse 10, we read, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had to come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Now, these were governors of nearby areas. You have other peoples to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west. And here's somebody horning in on their territory. Very unhappy about this. They were also under the authority of the king of Persia. So what now? We have these fellows, Sanballat and Tobiah. And after Nehemiah had ridden around the city, and he realized that the Jerusalem was still in ruins, the gates had been burned with fire, he says in verse 17, "Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." And they replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began the work. But what happens then in verse 19? Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab heard about it. What did they do? They mocked and ridiculed us. Do you ever want to do something that was important to you, and somebody else made a snide comment, a sarcastic remark, maybe whether wittingly or unwittingly put obstacles in your way, made life difficult, whether it's at work or at school? And one of the most cutting things that people do is to mock or ridicule someone. They don't answer the challenge or their concerns with reasoned discourse. They don't say, "Well, I don't think that'd be a good idea, and here's all the reasons why." Usually that mock or the ridicule they find pierces to the heart. It's very painful. And I think we've all felt that from time to time. Somewhere along the way, we've had some mocking or some ridiculing that has hurt us come thrown in our way. And it's not any fun. And it's very debilitating. I know in the world, in the political world, there are a lot of political cartoons that are drawn that focus on mocking and ridicule the opponent. I teach an American government class at the high school level, and I have a weekly homework assignment. They have to go out and bring a cartoon in every week, and a 2 to 3 sentence explanation is to this cartoon. And it is remarkable, these cartoons, how many of them, some of them will answer the question or address a matter showing the absurdity of something, but others simply mock and ridicule without any real reasoning behind it. And so you can see this, and this is nothing new. This has been going on for a very long time, mocking and ridiculing. And this happened to Nehemiah. So Nehemiah had this. Well, have you ever been mocked or ridiculed about keeping the Sabbath, maybe, or keeping the holy days? Maybe about unclean foods or anything that related to drugs or alcohol or anything else that people can dream up. Remember my wife years ago said in grad school she was going for the fall holy days, and the professor said, "Well, that's silly." I wasn't going about to make any accommodation. I'm thinking, well, I guess we know where he stands, and made it rather difficult. But mocking and ridicule is often an effective tool that people use to keep you from getting to your goal. So Nehemiah faced this, but it wasn't this. And as you recall, and I'm not going to turn there, but if you recall, Noah found the same thing. Well, he was building an ark for 100 years, and he had to suffer a lot of mock and ridicule at that time too. Also happened to Lot, living in Sodom, had to suffer a lot of mocking and ridicule at that time. So each of us have to face those kinds of obstacles, as did Nehemiah. And so how do we react when we get hammered with the mocking or the ridicule? And so, do we exercise the kind of patience and preparedness that Nehemiah did? But remember what Nehemiah's first he first did, and we read that in Nehemiah 1. We also read the reference in Nehemiah 2 that said Nehemiah prayed. So the first thing he did was pray to be right with God, pray that he that they turn from the wrong way, do the right thing, and then pray for wisdom on how to answer the king. In other words, he made some commitments ahead of time to do the right thing, so that would strengthen him, so that he would be prepared to handle this, the kind of obstacles that would come along. And then his opponents, Sanballat and Tobiah, said, "Are you rebelling against the king?" Ooh. So now they're trying to make it look as if he's not being responsible to his old boss, the king of Persia, that he's really rebelling against the king. And so they're openly saying, "Hey, you're rebelling against the king?" And that's got to be uncomfortable, because how would you like somebody going behind your back telling the boss, you know, they're really working against you and against the company? They're trying to sabotage your life. And you go, "Oh, man, you know, how do we deal with that?" And so if we have the same kinds of experiences, are we able to handle them as smoothly as did Nehemiah? If we read in verse 20 of chapter 2, "I answered them by saying, 'The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it.'" And then in chapter 3, it goes around and it tells about who was repairing what gate. And they went through the details. They were organized. He said about different families and different groups, and they were each building or repairing different parts of the gate. And they were busy. And so you look, and we can read through chapter 3, who all did which repairs, and it's really a list. It's like the contractor's list of who all the subcontractors are and who's responsible for what. And the various gates. So everybody had personal responsibility for an assignment in their area. But then we jump to chapter 4, and it says, "But it came to pass when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall," in other words, Sanballat wasn't standing there, he was sending other people to mock and ridicule them, "he became angry and greatly incensed." He ridiculed the Jews, we heard that. "And in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria," he was the governor of Samaria to the north, he says, "By what are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring back these stones to life from those heaps of rubble buried as they are?" And then Tobiah the Ammonite, he was a governor in the to the other side, to the east, said, "What are they building? Even a fox climbed up on it, it would break down their wall." They were mocking them. Says, "What can you do?" You know, trying to belittle them at every step. And What did Nehemiah do? And he prayed then in verse 4, in chapter 4, "Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Don't cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight. They've thrown insults in the face of the builders." So verse 6, "So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart." Verse 7, "But when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs and the Ammonites, the men of Ashdod, heard the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it." So what was the response for Nehemiah then? Verse 9, "But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat." So his response was, first again, he would pray. And then what is the second thing? He took action. Okay? He didn't sit on his hands. He didn't say, "Well, I don't know. Looks kind of rough. I hope we don't die." he said that they took action to defend themselves. And in other words, he didn't. He was watchful. So he prayed. He watched. They knew what was going on around them, and they were watching the circumstances. In fact, I want to turn back to Acts 10 to reinforce the idea that the first thing that he did was to pray. So let's take a look at Acts 10. If I can jump back to it. Acts 10, and I think it's verse 2. Talking about a fellow here, a man named Cornelius, who was a centurion in the Roman army, and the description of him in verse 2, a devout man and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. His focus as a Christian was to pray. That doesn't mean he prayed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In other words, it was always on his mind. He was ready and easily ready to communicate with God. So Cornelius, a Roman soldier and a committed and converted man, and his household, interestingly enough, followed his example, was an active prayer, as was Nehemiah. Let's then turn to Ephesians 6. I think it's in Ephesians, right after Galatians, Ephesians 6, and verse 18. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. That's the King James. Let's float over to the New NIV. And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep praying for all the saints. This is what Nehemiah was doing. He was staying alert. Okay, he was praying, and then as we read in Ephesians, it says, stay alert so that you may pray for the benefit of God's people. So Nehemiah, first of all, he prayed, and then he stayed alert. He watched as to what was going on. If we take a look in Luke 21 and verse 36, why was he watching? Why was he mindful? Why did he come and he quietly went around the walls of the city? And we take a look at Luke 21, verse 36, if I can get there. In Luke 21, if I get it right. Unless I got the wrong verse here. I must have written the wrong verse down, but basically it was to watch always and that you may be counted worthy to escape the things that are to come. And so, I'm in the wrong chapter. No wonder I could, it didn't look familiar. Here we go. Watch you therefore and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So Nehemiah had that same attitude. He was watchful. Not only did he pray, but he watched to see that he would be accounted. He didn't want to suffer the harm and the danger that would happen with Sanballat and Tobiah. And so he not only prayed, but he did something about it. He was watchful about that, as it tells us here in Luke. And then if we read also, if we go on and we're back to Nehemiah. Let me get back to Nehemiah here. I tell people to put a thumb in that spot or a marker, and then I didn't do it. Nehemiah in chapter 4. And we're there, and it's, and you know, in Nehemiah 4 and verse, if we can come to it here, in verse 23, the people had to be pretty diligent. Now, they were fighting, they were trying to build a wall. And we read that in verse 17. They were so watchful, and the enemy was upon them. In verse 17, for they which build it on the wall, and they that bear the burdens with those that laded, for every one with one of his hands in the work, and the other with his hand on a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword guided by his side, and so builded, and he that sounded the trumpet was by me. In other words, close to Nehemiah. They were prepared for the circumstances that they were surrounded with. So they prayed, they watched, and then they took action to make sure that they weren't going to get hurt. Now, the situation was so stressful. Can you imagine working with one hand, trying to be prepared to defend yourself with the other hand, to put on a show so that the other guys wouldn't attack you? Because if they thought that you were letting your guard down, then they could come in and stop the builders and hurt and kill the builders so they wouldn't rebuild the wall. Go down to verse 23. And if we read verse 23... Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon on, even when he went for water. So now, not bathing, I know, can get kind of grubby after a while. This was, 15 years ago. My father had a little, had excised about a marble-sized growth and right in the crease, where his leg met the torso. So you couldn't really move it very well. And so they took this marble-sized little tumor out, and he had it all patched up, but he couldn't take a shower. Because no matter what, he couldn't take a bath, couldn't take a shower, just couldn't. And it was right in that crease that was always difficult to keep sealed. So all he could do was sponge off until it was all healed up. And I remember the day, and I was there visiting, and he said, I cannot tell you how good it feels to take a shower today, because it was close to 90 days before he was through with the process, because they were using radiation to kill the cancer around that particular little spot, and so that kept it from healing as fast as it would have. And he had never gone 90 days without that kind of bathing in his entire memory, that life. And he said, words cannot describe. So here we are now, for many days, they're not taking off their clothes because they do not want to be caught unguarded. There was a neighbor I grew up with. He also had four boys, and as we did in our family, he fought for General Patton in World War II. And he was in the army as they fought up the boot in Italy, and they marched up through Italy on all the way up into Germany. And General Patton's army was so vigorous and moved so constantly, he said, we got one, at most, 2 hours of sleep at any one time. And he said, I didn't take my boots off for 3 weeks. Now, at that point, you would think that the boot and the foot would have kind of grown together, and that it would have killed all living things with a certain radius around that area. So you can imagine now the situation with Nehemiah's people and all of these families that were... that were partaking of the building. They didn't take off their clothes. Not pretty well says it, that it was a pretty anxious time. It was on a war footing for survival. So Nehemiah was committed to his goal, and the people followed him, and they followed. So you can't imagine that he was over there luxuriating in this bath while they were busy building the wall. They followed his example. If he said the people didn't take off their clothes to defend themselves, you can be pretty sure that he wasn't doing it either at that time. And then we have the example. If we take a look at up in verse or in chapter 6, we read about an example of somebody who claimed to be Nehemiah's friend. And this is an interesting story if we turn to Nehemiah 6, because sometimes people who claim to be your friend and have your best interests at heart don't always turn out to be the friend you thought they were. And so if we take a look in Nehemiah 6, we read about this Shemaiah fellow in Nehemiah 6, because remember these opponents, these other governors, Sanballat, Tobiah, and then there's Geshem the Arab in chapter 6, verse 1, and the rest of our enemies. they heard about that they had, that Nehemiah had rebuilt the wall and there was no gap left in it, but the gates weren't in place yet. Now, to put the gates in, remember, he had to find the trees, chop down the trees, turn the trees into beams and lumber, and then drill the holes through so they can put the pegs through, get them all sawed or fitted to the appropriate lengths, make the planks to make the gates. So it took time. So he had to have a team of woodworkers to make the gates. So they had the walls rebuilt, but the gates were still all open. And this was a problem. So they were still at risk from these enemy governors. And so the job was incomplete, and Nehemiah and us were still at risk. Do we feel at risk too sometimes? You know, when we're still vulnerable, and we're always seem to be vulnerable to something, because we're doing our part in God's work, and yet we have enemies surrounding us. They will throw ridicule at us. Sometimes it will be physical danger that we have. Sometimes it's financial danger. sometimes they will want to eat up our time. So this danger existed in Nehemiah's time. And so then we read about this friend of Nehemiah who made this suggestion in Nehemiah 6. And the friend, let's see, in Nehemiah 6, if we can find it, I think it's in verse 9. Here we go. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, the son of so-and-so, and so-and-so was shut up in the home. And he said, let's meet. In other words, he's in a safe place. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let's close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night they're coming to kill you. In other words, let's go to a safe place. You, Nehemiah, you know, I mean, they want to kill you. So why are you not living in the safest place in the temple where you can close the doors? Nehemiah wasn't a priest. He was a Jew, not a Levite. And as a result, only the Levites could live in the temple. And this would have violated the rules for the temple. And then, of course, somebody trying to get you to do something that you shouldn't do, then they could use that to mock you and against you. Aha! You didn't keep your own Sabbath. Aha! You didn't keep one of the commandments of God. Even though they wouldn't do it themselves, they would be quick to mock you. And what did they mock Christ about? They said, aha, you broke the Sabbath. Aha, you healed someone on the Sabbath. Aha, you plucked an ear of corn or some grain on the Sabbath. In other words, they were trying to find fault with Christ. And so here was somebody setting up Nehemiah to find, you know, that says, well, just be safe. Go in the temple. You'll be fine. You know, why did you expose yourself out here with all of this danger? And so we read on what Nehemiah says. Should a man like me run away, or should one like me go to the temple to save his life? I will not go. And then what does Nehemiah say? He says, I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. This fits into the ridicule portion that we started out with, the mocking. See, aha, you didn't keep your own laws and your own rules. Who are you anyway? So Nehemiah recognized that this person was not a friend. He was, in fact, hired by his enemies, pretending to be his friend. in Proverbs 1, let's turn to 1 Psalm 12 and verse 2. Let's go to Psalms 12. In verse 2. Does this remind you of Shemaiah when we read here in Psalms 12? Everyone lies to his neighbor. Their flattering lies speak with deception. Ouch. So he was in a position where his neighbor, someone who we thought he was his friend, you know, flattering him. Should a man like you, you know, I'd be out here suffering? No, no, no. You should go where it's safe. And so These kinds of friends are, will be around us, not true friends, but friends that will want us to commit some sin and praise us at the same time. Now let's turn to Proverbs 1 in verse 10. Psalms, Proverbs 1. Because when we're trying to achieve our goals, there's usually somebody around that wants to entice you in a slightly different direction, if not a completely different direction. My son, Proverbs 1 verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, don't consent. Or as Nancy Reagan would have said, 30 years ago, just say no, don't consent, don't agree to it. And Nehemiah recognized this, that, hey, wait a minute, if I say yes, then I would be committing a sin. I would be violating the temple because he knew he wasn't a Levite. And of course, the comparison there is as if that's not the kind of friend to have, well, then what kind of friend should we have? And we can go to Hebrews 10 and verse 24 to see the kind of friends that we should have in Hebrews 10 and verse 24. In Hebrews 10:24, and let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. This is how you define, or one of the definitions of being a friend, is that person spurring you on to love and good deeds. So that's one of the things that we did cover in camp, is those are the kinds of people that you want to surround yourself with, those that can help you to do the right thing. Because after all, we're identified as Christians as to how well we love one another. So are those people around us spurring us on? And of course, we know about a horse and you have spurs, you know, touching the spurs to the horse makes it go forward to love and good works. We can move down then in Nehemiah 6. If we go back to Nehemiah 6, what was the result of Nehemiah's determination? Because he stuck with his goal. We read the results in Nehemiah 6, and if we can turn to starting in verse 15. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. 52 days. They rebuilt the wall. They rebuilt the gates and secured the city. You can't get a building permit in any city around here in 52 days. Okay? That Nehemiah had his building permit from the king of Persia. He already had permission. Go get the materials, take care of business. And as we read on at that time, that Nehemiah went on to be the governor for the next 12 years before he returned to Persia. So the determination of the example of Nehemiah is something that is helpful for us. If we take a look at this story, and there's more to the story, but I did want to cover how determined Nehemiah was and what the things are, the principles that he used. He prayed. He prayed before he saw the king. He prayed before he answered the king. He prayed when he was in trouble. Prayer was his first resort. He communicated with God. He asked God for guidance. The second thing he did is he was observant. He watched. He watched because in order to achieve his objective, he didn't go blabbing it to everybody that would be able to hurt him or be able to be an obstacle. He was watchful. He was observant. He went around the city. He didn't tell anybody until he had met his own people and said, here's what we're going to do, and let's just start doing it. So he watched, and as we read also, that's our job, is to also watch, is to watch and be counted worthy to escape the terrible things that are yet to come. And just like Nehemiah watched to escape those things, he didn't want to get hurt or killed. And so he was watchful. And the third thing is that Nehemiah took action. I don't believe I turned to Acts 22 and verse 16. I do want to turn to there in Acts 22, 16. Because that separates the dreamers from the doers, is that taking action. So in Acts 22, 16, and this was a case here where Paul is saying, let's see, get to 16. And now what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away and call on his name. In other words, people were waiting for just for God to do everything. And he said, no, you've got to do something. You've got to make a decision. You've got to make one that matters. Get up and be baptized. Take some action here. Make things happen. And Nehemiah was making things happen. He just didn't hope for the best. He just didn't say, well, we prayed and we watched, and now we'll twiddle our thumbs and da-di-da. No, this is the same thing that the apostle Paul said, is to rise up, take action. You have a responsibility. And then Micah in 5:7. We can turn to Micah 5:7. If I can find Micah 5:7. Those minor prophets are not thick books. And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as the dew from the Lord, as showers upon the grass that tarried not for man, nor waits for the sons of men. You can't wait for other people. You can't wait for Aunt Margaret or Uncle Harry. You can't wait for this or that or the other thing. You're going to have to take action to get things done. Nehemiah didn't wait. He took action. Okay? He saw the obstacles that were before him. He knew the obstacles were there. He didn't discount them. He was very watchful for that. He knew that if he didn't take action, it would have a negative consequence. So the lesson from Nehemiah is being able to be a leader, was to establish determination. And Nehemiah was determined. He prayed, he watched, and he took action. So we can take a look at that example in our lives. Do we have those priorities in order? Are we prayerful? Are we observant? And then, do we take action?